If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. I'm Millie Cawthorne. In today's episode, we've got the second part of our latest Everything You Wanted to Know But Were Afraid to Ask episode on ancient Greece. In these podcasts, we combine popular search queries with questions that you've sent to us via our social media channels. Since this was such a big subject, we've broken it down into two parts. You can find the first part from last Sunday on our podcast feed. Our expert is Professor Paul Cartledge, a classicist based at the University of Cambridge. And putting the questions to him was our digital editor, Emma Mason.
What sort of role did women play? What rights did they have in ancient Greece?
Again, one must distinguish between different cities. You can't just say Greek women, you've got to say Spartan women as opposed to Athenian women. Actually, that's rather a useful distinction here. Because whereas Spartan women could own land, whereas Spartan women, because of their husbands being constantly on a military footing and away from home much of the time, they actually ran their homes, the Spartan women. They had control. And because they were in a funny way respected, because being a mother of a Spartan young boy and man, it wasn't an easy thing. And Spartan women's voices are heard in a way that other Greek women's voices are not heard. So for all those reasons, Spartan women folk, vis-a-vis their men, seem to have been relatively privileged. And very relatively, their situation, their status was superior to that of their Athenian sisters, who could not own property of any size, who were always underage. In terms of the law, they were never adult. They always had a male guardian, normally their father until they got married, when they got married, their husband, or if their husband died, his nearest male relative. So it might be her brother-in-law or whatever. So Spartan women were always much superior to the Athenian in the sense they were fully adult at law, whereas Athenian women were minors at law. On the other hand, within the Athenian citizen women population, one must make distinctions. And I've already, of course, talked about rich and poor. If you were the wife of a rich man, or if your dad was rich, so gave you a very big dowry, then your situation was considerably more comfortable than if you were a poor Athenian woman, no dowry to speak of, had to work, as, and it's the old thing about the double oppression of women. They both work outside the home, and then in the home they also have to work for their husband. Then that makes a very big difference whether you were rich or poor, whether you had a slave to do some work for you or you did all your own work yourself. Another distinction was whether or not you held a religious office. And to begin with, the only Athenian women qualified to hold religious offices were aristocrats. And the Athenians did have a notion of those who were aristocrats and those who weren't. So in other words, we would say those with titles and those who hadn't. And the most senior religious office in the entire Athenian state was the priestesshood of the patron goddess of the state. This is Athena of the city. And only women from a certain family, aristocratic, were eligible to hold that office of state. So, I mean, it's like the Archbishop of Canterbury, as it were. She was a woman in Athens. And the richer you were, broadly speaking, the more confined you were. The key worry for a wealthy husband was that your wife might have an affair, and an affair that produced a child, and a child that would therefore potentially have a claim on your estate without being your genetic descendant. And that would be extremely both irritating, in other words, a matter of status. You would feel affronted, but also economically, potentially, not a good thing either. So sometimes the phrase is used, Oriental seclusion. I mean, it's a phrase from another period, but what it means is that, as we know, in some parts of the world today, certain types of women are particularly supervised, chaperoned, not allowed to go out in public at all, or if allowed out, only with a male relative watch, etc., etc. Well, many Athenian women found themselves in that situation, whereas many Spartan women did not, because their condition, their status in life, their mode of life was very different from that of the Athenians. And we're talking mainly about urban situations, and there are court cases arising from alleged infractions. In other words, where one party alleges that the other party has had sex with his wife or whatever, and therefore is suing.
And is it true that a husband who found out his wife was being unfaithful with another man could murder the male lover without fear of prosecution?
All that you say there is true until the last few words, without fear of prosecution. Because what, suppose you are of the family that the man has been killed, allegedly by the husband. The husband alleges he was killed because he was an adulterer. The husband alleges that he found the adulterer in bed with his wife. You've got to have that literal contiguity. It's not enough that he's just walking out of the door. He's got to be actually in flagrante delicto. Well, suppose you're the, I don't know, the wife or the brother or the father of such a man who's killed. Might you not think, this guy wanted to kill my son, my brother, my cousin, and claimed he'd been having sex with his wife when he really hadn't? That was just a made-up excuse. Well, we have one such trial exactly of that nature, where the man on trial is the one who killed the man, alleging that he killed him legitimately because he was in flagrante delicto with his wife. So the answer to your question is yes, legally, if a man, a husband, kills another man who is in bed with his wife, at that moment, that is not in itself a crime.
And what was life like for female sex workers?
Right. Big distinction has to be drawn here. It's again one of high and low, rich and poor. If you're a street walker, as we used to use the phrase, in Greek, you're a porne. It's where we get our word pornography from. And porne is based, the root is to buy. So you are a bought person, bought for sex. You're a sex worker, but you're a bought sex worker. And typically, you operate either from a very, you know, your own sordid home in a poor part of, I'm talking about Athens here, or you're a brothel prostitute. And you're then called a porne. You have a madam, and madam has a pimp, and it's all quite familiar in terms of sordid, sort of low-class prostitution. Very cheap in the port of Piraeus, sailors just there for a day, they want a bit of sex, they go to one of these brothels. So nothing particularly surprising about that. The surprising or the unusual, the peculiar to the ancient Greeks type of prostitution that is very, very different from that is involves a class of women who were known, it's a euphemism, as companions. Oh no, they're not sex workers. They are companions. And so the equivalent, I mean, insofar as it is an equivalent, is of the system in Japan of geishas, some of whom, at any rate, will also have sex as well as entertain you on music on the samisen or whatever. So these companions were typically not Athenian in Athens. They were foreign women, and they were well-educated. Now you ask, how did they become educated? Well, they came from educated homes in which the parents had not prevented them becoming literate, and in fact, they might even read poetry and so on and so on. And they could play an instrument. They could, in other words, entertain not purely with their bodies, let's put it that way. Well, they were very expensive. And so we're talking like the quarter of Edo, you know, where all the famous woodcut etchings of those prostitutes, the ukiyo-e woodcuts. This is something equivalent to that in Athens. High-class prostitution involving free elite women, typically non-Athenian, with upper-class, very rich Athenian men.
And you mentioned education there. So did wealthy Athenian women receive any sort of education?
Yes, by and large, that would be the case, because there were certain situations in which it would be very helpful, to put it mildly, to be literate. So I mentioned the priestesshoods. Well, obviously, she would need to be literate. There would be documents to read, prayers to recite, all sorts of things. And the higher up the scale you go in terms of culture, well, hymns, of course, poems of different sorts. There are prayers, a lot of things set to verse. And there is, in fact, one very famous Greek lady. I mean, there are more than one Greek poetess known, but the most famous is a lady called Sappho. In Greek, Sappho. She came from the island of Lesbos, which today, sadly, is more famous or notorious for having lots of refugees. But Lesbos is off the Turkish coast, northwest Aegean. And Sappho and her female students or friends, they both composed verses, sang verses, and most interesting of all, had them written down. In other words, they were preserved. That's why we know some of what Sappho actually composed. And Plato, who was not a great feminist in many ways, but he was a great connoisseur of poetry, he called Sappho the 10th muse. She was so, because muses are all female, there are 9 of them, and one of them is a muse of poetry. But she was so famous in his day, this is about 400 BC in Athens, that he thought that highly of her. But by and large, most Athenian women, most probably were at most literate. I mean, there wouldn't be much more than that. In Sparta, similar situation. We have dedications which Spartan women make to the gods. I offer this to Poseidon or to Hera or Athena or whatever. And in the Greek world, generally, one must assume most women were at best functionally literate and numerate, but nothing much more than that. There were no schools, by the way. I mean, hardly any, I won't say no, there were hardly any formal educational establishments, even for boys. So a fortiori, not for girls either.
There's an awful lot of interest online about homosexuality in ancient Greece and the practice of pederasty. Maybe you could introduce that to us. What was pederasty?
To us, it's sensitive because any sex with a child, which is what pais means, is in itself problematic and illegal. Paiderastia literally means lust for, love of, in a strong sexual sense, children. And it could be of either sex. The word pais is unisex. It could be an underage sub-adult, either male or female. But paiderastia refers specifically to boys. And it is, who is the arastes? Who are the lovers? Who are the active element in this binary relationship? They are adults, so they're over 20. They might even be married. They might be what you and I would call a preferred or exclusive homosexual, but they might be married as well. And that's, of course, not unknown in our society. And the difficulty comes with just at what age was the younger, the junior, the sub-adult party, and how much agency would that junior partner have? In other words, if you're 12, you're probably going to be less able to have a say, either in resisting or in manipulating or determining the nature of the relationship with the older man, than if you're 18. However, if you are 18 or 17, 18, you're still a pais. You're still subject to that disability. You're not a legally independent adult. And therefore, you might well be the junior partner in a homosexual relationship with a man only a few years older than you. In other words, it might be quite equal. So let's put it this way, it's extremely complicated. You can't just say, oh, well, pederasty was like this. It had lots of shades of grey. Very rarely was it criminalised. In other words, as such, it was not a subject of a criminal action. But if you were a rent boy, in other words, if you were, let's say, 17, and you openly or covertly offered your body for purely sexual reasons to an adult male, that could be subject to an accusation of criminal prostitution, which would have political consequences. There were rules forbidding sexual congress or sexual arrangements in the gymnasium. So lots of Greek cities had areas where you exercise, because the Greeks were very keen on athletics, especially wrestling. And they typically exercise nude, which is why it's called a gymnasium. Gymnos means naked. So there were rules barring you if you were a slave. You couldn't go in the gymnasium because that would be too easy for a free citizen adult male to just do what he wanted to. So they were barred. It was not allowed if you were under 40 to be in a gymnasium with young boys present. So there were rules, regulations. It's not a free-for-all. And that raises the question, was there any sort of, as there is today, and of course we have reinforcement from scripture, any negativity surrounding it? Was it thought to be in itself a questionable activity? Well, there is this one area, and it's about power. And of course, it's for that extent extremely contemporary when we think about male-female relations today. if it was thought that the junior partner was being forced into it, let's say his individuality, his identity was being denied as a free citizen, though he was not adult, he was still free, then that was not good. And that was thought to be something to be frowned upon. And so there, as it were, predators of whom they existed, who went around looking for young boys to get off with, to have sex with, that was frowned upon very strongly. And on the other hand, what we never know is exactly the balance between compulsion and free will in any relationship. It's always difficult, but where one person by definition is adult and the other one is by definition younger, there's that imbalance and inequality by definition, and therefore in that sense it was always problematic. Except, and this is the one exception in the whole of the Greek world, and it's Sparta, where it seems that this relationship was not optional at all. In other words, if you're going to go through the educational cycle at Sparta, part of it is pairing up with an adult Spartan warrior for mutual benefit. The older partner instructs you, is your mentor. The junior partner provides sexual satisfaction and companionship in a society where before you're married, it's actually very difficult to have any relation with the opposite sex. And so Spartans, like most Greeks, typically didn't marry till the age of 25 or older.
And was paederasty a factor for young girls as well?
There is just one passage in a very late source about Sparta, and it's to do with education. So since for the boys, it was educational to be in a relationship with an older, with an adult male, as the girls had some form of public education, which is very extraordinary, and it involved athleticism as well as learning to read and write, then it's not utterly inconceivable what this source says, which is that very high-ranking Spartan women might select what they took to be suitable girls, i.e. 15, 16, before they were married, as a female partner. But, well, we tend to think it's slightly dubious, the very notion. Nowhere else in the Greek world. Except, and then, of course, I go back to Sappho, and there we're in Lesbos, we're in a much earlier period. Some of the women might not have been Greek. It might have been a sort of international thing, and it was just particular to that place at that time. It doesn't become an established institution. But, of course, Sappho has given her name to, it's an old name for a lesbian, namely a Sapphic. And Sapphics are called Sapphics after Sappho. Lesbians are called lesbians after the island of Lesbos, where Sappho came from.
And what about the perception of homosexuality more widely? Was it celebrated in ancient Greece? Was Oscar Wilde right in his suggestion of a sort of gay utopia?
Well, he's both right and wrong, insofar as there was no religious argument against it, as there was for him. Judeo-Christian tradition is very down on homosexuality. Insofar as it was celebrated in myth in the ancient world, Heracles had boyfriends, and that was great. In those terms, compare it with late 19th century Victorian England. Boy, I would have taken ancient Greece any time if I was gay then. But on the other hand, it's complicated for the reasons I've given. You've got to be careful. The protocols, how you do your paederasty, mattered. It wasn't just that it wasn't criminalised. It had to be done in the proper way. And then there's a famous or rather notorious passage of Plato, and it's in the Laws, and he's talking about, well, how should we regulate sexual relations? Are homosexual, as we call it, it's a modern term, are same-sex relations okay between men? Well, no, because they are unnatural. Why are they unnatural? Because they don't give rise to offspring, reproductive naturalism. He anticipates the Christian view of the purpose of marriage being to produce legitimate offspring, to have sex only within marriage. Well, Plato, having previously in an earlier work celebrated through his mouthpiece, Socrates, same-sex relationships of a, it could be sexual, but not exclusively sexual kind, which elevates the behaviour of both of them. It's a sort of higher form of converse than purely physical, which is what male-female might be thought to be, because women were not educated to be equals with men, typically in ancient Greece. So Plato goes from, in a way, celebrating a form of idealized, spiritualized same-sex homosexuality to a position of very negative down on it. And if I was to be crude, I'd say, well, as he got older, he wasn't that interested or that capable of having sex with anybody. He never married, which is very unusual. And I think, therefore, whether or not he was, a preferred homosexual, by the end, he's pretty sour and embittered, and he's quite down on any sort of what he considers deviant behaviour. And he has fierce punishments in this ideal state, which is not very ideal by most of our standards.
Well, Todd Patton on Facebook asks, why were homosexuality and bisexuality accepted in ancient Greece but not in Rome?
I've thought about this. It's very, very hard to say. I mean, one reason is if you conquer a people and you think yourself, therefore, superior to them, you look for the things that differentiate your civilization from theirs. And the Romans singled out their abhorrence, their rejection of this deviant custom among the Greeks of homosexuality, which they thought was effeminate. At least one party in any homosexual relationship, they thought, must play the part of the woman. So it's not what a true Roman masculine man should do. And you might immediately think, as I immediately think, what about the Spartans? They institutionalized pederasty, homosexuality. They were no wimps. So the point is, the Romans were being very selective in what they chose not to adopt from the Greeks. They actually adopted a great deal of other stuff, but this was one custom which they, like, I mean, there have been many other cultures that have thought it a terrible thing. And of course, typically any Judeo-Christian culture does officially think of it as a terrible thing in terms of its primary documents. So I think that's the answer. The Romans conquered the Greeks. Greeks were feeble. One reason they were feeble, or one manifestation of their feebleness, was their addiction to buggery.
So turning to religion, what role did religion play in ancient Greece? What did people believe?
So first of all, it's slightly strange, and we have this phrase, the Greeks had a word for it. They didn't have a word for religion. So they had paraphrases, the things of the gods and the goddesses, but not religion as such, no one word, which is a Latin-derived term. The Greeks thought that the gods and the goddesses and heroes and heroines were everywhere. So the whole world is full of gods, Thales, a famous philosopher, said. So there wasn't a distinction in that we might have between the secular world and the religious world. Everything was more or less religious. Difference from anything post Christianity, Islam, and of course Judaism is contemporary. Greeks were polytheists. They believed there were many, many, many gods and goddesses, not monotheists, which means you believe there's one divinity. And they weren't even henotheists, which means you believe there are more than one god, and but one of them is the most important. So they were thoroughgoing polytheists and, in a way, pantheists.
Where was religion practiced?
There were separate spaces. The Greeks actually had a word meaning a cut-out space, so where a sanctuary which might or might not include a temple was. So there are, as it were, shrines and specifically religious spaces in terms of an altar and a temple. But religion was practiced everywhere. You go to battle, you slaughter an animal before the battle to get the will of the gods. You look at its liver, and then if it's favourable, you go to battle. If it's not, you don't. So battlefield, you're at home. You wake up in the morning, you have your family Hermes just outside your back door. You pour a libation, that is wine or some other liquid, it might be olive oil, and that is your way of making your peace with the gods. Constantly there's a to-ing and fro-ing. There's a sort of notion of a contract that if you, the human, do the gods favours, if you look after them, if you worship them, give them their due, then the gods are bound by contract to do you a favour in return. It's a give and take. So religion was everywhere in principle, and just about any phenomenon could be given a religious interpretation. A rainbow, well, the Greeks had a word for that, a goddess called Iris. The sun is a god, Helios. Or you look at a spring. Ah, there's a nymph playing there, female. You pour a libation to that nymph. So everywhere, Greeks were massively religious. And that's why it's a bit of a paradox that some Greeks were able to draw a distinction and actually to even question whether the gods, I mean Zeus, Hermes, and so on, were real or whether they were figments of human imagination. So, in other words, you get the beginnings of atheism through humanism, as well as normally most Greeks being what you and I would call very religious.
And you mentioned Zeus and Hermes there. How many Greek gods and goddesses?
Absolutely countless, in the sense that you can multiply one god or goddess by giving her or him a different epithet. I'll just give you one example. Athena. Athena Polias is the patron goddess of Athens. But if you go up on the Acropolis, there are two other temples to different Athenas. One of them is Athena Parthenos, the virgin, the maiden. That's the Parthenon. And then there's another one called Athena Nike. If you own running shoes by Nike, that means victory. So there's one goddess, three different manifestations. For the Greeks, three different goddesses. So there were 12 Olympians, in other words, a kind of stable family dominated by Zeus. It's a patriarchy, remember. And his sister, wife, full sister, wife, Hera, they're, as it were, the senior members of the family. And then there are 10 others. But they're just, I mean, I put it that way, they're the most powerful, but they are only 10, 12 out of thousands. And they were all thought to live on the top of the highest mountain in Greece, which is Mount Olympus, which is over 10,000 feet.
And one particularly popular search question I came across was, what were the ancient Greeks so superstitious about?
There is an actual text. It's a very useful one. It's by a pupil of Aristotle. So it's late in the 4th century BC. A man who came from the same island as Sappho. He's called Theophrastus. And he wrote a work called Characters. And there were 30 of them. And they're, as it were, types. So, you know, the braggart. The oligarch. Well, one of them is the superstitious man. So what he's superstitious about, oh gosh, a black cat, and on the right, and it was at a crossroads. You know, so just like us, as it were, superstition in the very negative sense. But the Greek word, interestingly, which we translate superstition, which is a Latin-derived word, means literally fearing or fearful of demons. And the distinction there is gods are theoi, which is where we get theistic and theological, but demons are daimon, daimonion. It's where we get our word demon, daimonic, demonic. And so they're lesser. So a superstitious man makes the mistake of thinking that the most important supernatural powers are these rather undefined spirits floating around in the atmosphere, rather like you or I might think of COVID in the atmosphere, drops, you know. Well, the real thing a religious, a properly religious person would say to him is, don't worry about black cats. What you need to worry about is if you go to Delphi and Apollo's priestess tells you something you really don't want to hear, that's what you've got to do. Forget about all the others. They're relatively trivial.
And what role did oracles play?
Well, I just mentioned the Delphic Oracle. That was the most significant because it was thought to be the most holy, the most authoritative. You consult an oracle by various means, for example, looking at entrails, or by getting a prophecy, which is a form of utterance, which is meant to be inspired, directly inspired by, in this case, Apollo. And it will tell you an answer to a question. And if you're an ordinary person, you're not a statesman, you're not heading a public mission asking about some mega affair of state. You want to know, should I marry Artemisia, who lives three doors down from me and has known, you know, that, then the answer is yes or no. Will I have good children if I marry Artemisia, as opposed to if I marry someone else, or if I don't marry? And that's, of course, more difficult for the answerer to give. So people did use this as a kind of, Lonely Hearts column, where, you find out things about your personal life which you want to control desperately, but actually you can't. So there are two types, or main types, of oracle. One is the public official one advising a city or an individual ruler. The other is the purely individual. And there are various ways in which oracles are delivered. But lots of Greeks at one or other point in their life, typically these life crises, marriage, birth, death, would consult an oracle. What's the future likely to be? Or how should I behave? Should I do this or should I do that?
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
All those statues we don't want up. There should be a gallery of the overthrown, as it were, the dispossessed, a kind of rogues gallery of what we mustn't do.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
We don't always realize just how much our negative thoughts and experiences stick with us and weigh us down. You may find your brain constantly running through a highlight reel of bad moments. That comment your friend made last week that hurt your feelings. That frustrating thing your mum does. Or that silly thing you said in a meeting. Maybe it's time to get it all off your chest. Whether it's a tiny annoyance or something much bigger, talking about it can give you some relief and lead you to a potential solution. That's where therapy comes in. It's a safe space to share whatever's weighing you down and learn to process it so your internal highlight reel can focus on the good stuff. And BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Let it out with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/historyextra today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/History Extra.
Moving on to the Olympics, there's a huge wealth of questions about that online. Maybe you could just start by telling us why the Olympics were so important.
They were important because they were religious. They were in honour of Zeus of Mount Olympus. That's why they're called Olympics, though they were actually celebrated not at Mount Olympus, but down in the Peloponnese northwest at a place which was called Olympia. They're important because they're religious. They're important because only Greeks may take part. So they were what we call pan-Hellenic, all Greeks, only Greeks. And to begin with, in terms of the actual participants, they were only for men, boys as well as adults, but only males. Later, it becomes possible if you own, for example, a racehorse, or if you own a four-horse chariot, then you can enter that and you're the owner and you win the prize, if you win the prize. And the prize is just a symbolic prize, not a money prize. It's just an olive wreath. You then can become a female Olympic winner. But actually, there wasn't one for 400 years. The games were originated in early 8th century, but it wasn't until 396 BC that the first female Olympic victor, who was a Spartan, a princess, she owned a four-horse chariot. Her chariot won the four-horse chariot race. But the first event, and it was always the most important symbolically, was just a dash. It was about the 200-metre sprint. And so the person who won that gave his name to the game. So if Orsippus won it, that games was the Games of Orsippus. They were celebrated every 4 years, always in the same spot. And Greeks, as the Greek world expanded, out west far as Spain, up north and east as far as what's today Georgia. So you get competitors and eventually winners from all around the Hellenic world, all around the Mediterranean, all around the Black Sea. But some cities made a special fetish of trying to breed winners. And so in other words, they had dedicated training grounds and they put a lot of money into even bribing people to come and leave their native city to come and sign up. It's rather like cricket today or other sports where foreigners become naturalized to play for another country. And one of those was in the south of Italy, what's called Great Greece, a place called Crotone. That seems to have specialized in producing winning sprinters. Other athletes were heavy event competitors. So they did wrestling, they did boxing, and then others did a bit of both. They did wrestling and javelin throwing and sprinting, and there were five, and they were called pentathletes. It's where the original pentathlon came from. And then as time went on, the Olympics spawned three, not exactly rivals, but imitators. In other words, three other major pan-Hellenic games. One in Delphi, one in Corinth, and one a place in the Peloponnese called Nemea. And Nemea, like Olympia, was in honor of Zeus. The one at Corinth was in honor of Poseidon, and the one at Delphi was in honor of Apollo. And the ultimate accolade was to be an athlete who'd won, or a wrestler, whatever, who'd won the prize. And there was only ever one prize, no silver medals, no bronze medals, at each of the four main pan-Hellenic games.
And why were they held every 4 years?
There is a view, actually, that originally they were held every year, in other words, annually, but that because they took such a lot of organisation, and it's rather like modern Olympics, though they're always in the same place, nevertheless, the build-up to each one, and if you've got the other three added in, so that there were two in 1 year, you know, it operated that there was two in each of the four-year cycle. You'd have two in 1 year, then one, then two in the, like that. A lot of preparation. They're all together with, we think, 50 games that a professional or semi-professional athlete could take part in. So you want to spread them out. But why were they 4 years to begin with? That's a very good question. It's a cycle which is not unknown elsewhere. For example, the Athenians' main festival was in honor of Athena, and it was called the Pan-Athenaic Festival. Well, every fourth year, that was a really big deal. So there were three minor versions, and then the fourth year, big deal. That probably was based on the Olympic notion of every 4 years is a big deal.
And when was the last ancient Greek Olympic Games.
Right. Christians, as you can imagine, were not keen on, for example, Zeus, Poseidon, Apollo, and therefore they wanted to expunge all traces of paganism. And gradually they got to the point where, following the foundation of Constantinople in 330, which we talked about earlier, the Byzantine Christian emperors became what we call, what they called, Orthodox. So extremely rabidly dogmatic. Not just Christians, but other Christians were heretics. Anything except my doxy is no good. You're going to go to hell if you don't believe what I believe is the truth about my religion. Well, one of these emperors, he was called Theodosius I, also nicknamed the Great. He simply uttered an edict. All pagan festivals must forever after cease now. And this was in 393 AD CE. So that's the end of the Olympics and any other pagan such religious athletic festivals.
And what happened between, obviously we still have the Olympic Games now, how did the Olympics change? How did we get to where we are today?
There was a complete absence of abeyance, obviously competitive sports, but nothing of an international or let alone global nature. During the 19th century, gradually the idea grows up that Germany, France, England, in some ways are the heirs to ancient Greek culture, civilization, and Roman, of course. And so one of these Philhellenes, when Greece revolted from the Ottoman Empire, a bunch of non-Greeks called Philhellenes sent them money or even went to fight, like Byron. So Philhellenism grew in the 19th century. And there was one particular Philhellene, he was a baron, he was called Baron de Coubertin. He got together an Olympic movement, interestingly inspired partly by coming to England, going to Much Wenlock in Shropshire, where there was held something called an Olympic Games. It was a purely local thing. Anyway, he got the idea from that, and he thought, why are the English so particularly successful in, for example, military matters? They beat us on the field of Waterloo. Well, is it because of something to do with the English education, with the way they do competitive sports, and so on? So he drew the inference it was, and that the way to make France great again, after the defeat by the Germans, 1870, was to introduce many more athletic competitions, building up to, and then in the 1890s, 1894, just actually at the time of Oscar Wilde, who was a Philhellene of another kind, there was the first meeting of the Proto-International Olympic Committee in Paris in 1894. They agreed we will hold the first revived Olympic Games, not in Olympia, which was a backwater, but in Athens, capital of Greece, the new state of Greece, in 1896. And the rest is history. That's when the modern Olympic Games movement restarted, 1896.
So what would you say is the biggest legacy of ancient Greece?
Democracy. But only in terms of its name, not directly as a legacy in terms of its form. Philosophy and science, the originators of the scientific method, the presupposition that you can understand the world of nature without invoking the divine as an explanation, that goes back to the ancient Greeks. Ultimately, it's an ancient Greek who points out that the earth goes round the sun. Absolutely heretical notion until Copernicus proved it thousands of years, you know, 1,000 years later. But Greeks make these terrific leaps forward. Theatre, the word is Greek. We do theatre in some sense because the ancient Greeks invented it. When the Renaissance comes along, texts of the ancient Greek dramatists were printed in Greek. And then when the modern theatre develops and inspiration is sought for discussion of such issues as when is it okay to defy the established regime? Think of Antigone, just one example. When is it not right to bury your brother? When is it necessary to commit civil war? And so on. Greek theatre was a problem-oriented theatre, especially Athenian, but often using myths derived from elsewhere than Athens, for example, Thebes. So theatre, philosophy, science, democracy, I would say, are the three main legacies which we have chosen to inherit and remake in our own ways in the modern Western world.
So turning now to the Elgin Marbles, that's obviously a lot of interest in that topic as well. So maybe you could just summarise for us what exactly the Elgin Marbles are and what the story is there.
It's a complicated story, the Elgin Marbles, named after the 7th Earl of Elgin, way up in the northeast of Scotland. He was our ambassador, our man in Istanbul, sometimes referred to in French as the Sublime Porte. So he was our ambassador to the Ottoman Empire. At that time, Greece, what was ancient Greece, so including Athens, was a subject state of the Ottoman Empire. And therefore, if you as a foreigner wanted to do anything in Athens, you had to get the permission either of the locals, the people who actually on the ground controlled Athens, and the Acropolis was a fort. It was a military occupation site, rather like Dublin in Ireland, was where we Brits conquered and dominated Ireland from Dublin Castle. Well, the Acropolis of Athens was the equivalent for the Ottoman Empire for Greece. So Elgin goes to the Sublime Porte, to Istanbul, in the late 18th century, 1798 or so. And somehow or other, and this is where the legal complexities kick in right from the beginning, gets some sort of permission to do something on the Acropolis of Athens. What it transpires he really wants to do initially is somehow remove what he takes to be both in themselves utterly admirable objects aesthetically, but also objects which are being neglected and which have been badly treated and which are likely to continue to be treated and therefore will deteriorate. He claims to be saving these Greek Hellenic artifacts for the West, for non-Ottoman. Ottoman Empire was the East, the terrible Turk, and he's saving them. Now, the timing of his intervention was fortuitous because at that very moment, Napoleon's France was attacking the Ottomans' Egypt. You've probably all heard of the Battle of the Nile, Nelson, 1790, just when Elgin is in Istanbul. So my enemy's enemy is my friend. So we are the enemy of the French. French are the enemy of the Ottomans. We are the enemy's friend, and therefore we are going to be the Sultan's friend. He gives Elgin some sort of permission. Between 1800 and 1804, in round numbers, Elgin and his, obviously not personally, but his agents and his workers remove as many of the objects from the Acropolis that they think are both portable, they're removable, portable, transportable to London eventually. But originally it's thought, he thought to his baronial seat up in Elgin in Scotland, not for the nation, but for him, because other aristocrats at Chatsworth and elsewhere, they had their collections, so why shouldn't he? And after all, he'd gone to Istanbul, you know. At any rate, they end up in London on display, and Elgin has spent a huge amount of money, partly his own, partly money that the government had given him, but not paying to the Ottoman sultan, but to bribe the governor of the Acropolis, to pay the workmen, to ship them, get them to the port, get them by sea. And of course, the first consignment sank off an island to the south of Athens. And terrible stories about how they got eventually to London. And there the issue was, and the government set up a committee of inquiry. Should the British nation acquire these from Elgin? They being considered as Elgin's property to sell. And there was a great inquiry. It took several weeks, and they eventually agreed. There was a lot of dissent in Parliament, an act of Parliament, whereby a sum of money was paid to Elgin, the marbles under his name, mainly from the Parthenon, were then the property of the British nation, and they were entrusted to the trustees of the British Museum, which had been founded in 1753, just 50, 60 years earlier. And that's where they've remained since 1817. They've been on display more or less there, and since the 1960s in the present gallery. So why is it controversial? Well, in 1800 or so, there was no modern Greek state. So it was a deal between Britain and then Turkey, nothing to do with the modern Greek state, which pretty much the first thing it did when it came into being in the 1830s was request or demand that we Brits give back what, now this is where the issue comes, did Elgin steal them? In a sense, yes, because he took clearly much more than any permit would have permitted, and he committed a lot of damage. I mean, a lot of the things fell down or they sank, you know, they never were. All sorts of awful things about the mode in which they came to the British Museum. Ultimately, it's somewhat like the situation we're in today about imperialism and slavery. We're talking about a very different world, but these things that were done then, which were thought to be okay then by some people, are not thought to be okay by lots of people now. So that's why there's an issue. And there is a dedicated international committee of various national committees. I'm on the British one, to try to persuade. Now, we're not persuading only the British Museum trustees, but the government, because it has to be by an Act of Parliament which rescinds that Act of Parliament of 1816, such that the British Museum must yield up these treasures. As of now, the British Museum trustees says, sorry, we own them, or rather, we own them on behalf of the British nation, so they must stay where they are, even though they're not brilliantly displayed, even though there's a dedicated, beautiful museum in Athens since 2009, in sight of the Acropolis. You actually see what's left of the Parthenon visually through a big picture window. All sorts of reasons why the reunification would be a very good thing, but it's very, very emotionally, politically, culturally charged.
So, in your view, do you think they ever will be returned?
I don't think anytime soon. I imagine a scenario where we, the British, that is the Parliament, so want to do the Greek state a favour, because, for example, Turkey, or it might be China, or it might be Russia, is putting through Greece huge pressure on our way of life. We so need, and we so want Greece to be on our side, and we want to do them a favour. Then and only then, I think it would be something as extreme as that that would prompt the British government of the day to propose an Act of Parliament in Parliament for it to be passed and then for them to go back. Ideally, of course, there should be mutual, fruitful, purely generous exchange. The marbles go back. In return, the Greeks make available temporary loan, terrific objects previously never seen in London in the BM. A friend of mine recently put a more wicked suggestion. You empty the gallery in which the Elgin marbles are shown, and into that you put not Greek statues from the ancient world, but all those statues of, let's say, Colston and other slavers, all those statues we don't want up. There should be a gallery of the overthrown, as it were, the dispossessed, a kind of rogues gallery of what we mustn't do. That is, be slavers, be imperialist, be sexist, and all the other terrible things that have been done in the past, supposedly with goodwill and with general support then, but no longer tolerable now.
And what would be the significance if they were returned?
For the Greeks, just an absolute flooding of joy. And there is a downside, which is that it's a bit nationalistic. You know, there's a sort of sense in which it plays to a sense of individual superiority as a nation. But actually, the history of Greece is much more complicated than that. On the other hand, over here, only, I think, some diehard reactionaries would be really sorry. And they would feel, I think, partly bruised pride that they'd somehow not hung on to them. And that, I think, is the feeling that motivates most trustees of the British Museum. You become a trustee, and then you feel the collection is yours, so that you'd be somehow being robbed of something that in some real sense is yours, when of course it isn't. Everything in the BM belongs to the British nation. The trustees are trustees. They hold it in trust for us. But there would be some ructions, and then they would have ripple effects. Other museums which hold bits of the Parthenon. But of course, what the defenders say, I'm sure this is the point of your question, floodgates. If the Elgin marbles go back to Greece, what about the Benin bronzes to Nigeria? What about, and then you could go on. Actually, the British Museum has repatriated certain objects that were previously in its possession. I'm talking about human remains from Australasia, for example, that have gone back, Aboriginal corpses, bones, but they've not repatriated any serious artifact as opposed to a human remain.
And just finally, you mentioned there Colston. Where do you stand on statues like this being taken down?
I'm one of those who believes that museums have a very important educative function, and that such statues, if they are found offensive by large numbers of persons in a public space, then they should be put into a less public or even private space. That is the sort of space a museum provides, with very full captions as to when the statue was commissioned, by whom, why it was set up then, why and how it was removed, and what is its now and likely future significance, as opposed to what was its significance or what was in the minds of the people who paid, for example, for Colston in 1895, I think it was.
And just finally, what can we expect from your latest book?
From Thebes? Well, that's a huge question. I, broadly speaking, point out or suggest that we should think of ancient Greek Thebes as, in its way, no less important than the other two or three really big numbers, that is Sparta, Athens, and Macedon with Philip and Alexander. Thebes was not just one city, I argue, it was two, a city of real historical significance, you know, the actual fabric, the politics, the people, but also a city of ideas, a city of myth. And the myths of Thebes, they had their own mythology, quite separate from, for example, the Trojan War. They had their own dynastic, and of course, we know about this. They had their founding myths and so on. But through the Athenians, and then much perhaps more recently, of course, modern interpreters, whether composers or playwrights or dramatists and directors, the Theban cycle of myth, Oedipus, Antigone, and so on, has become absolutely central to our Western tradition. Another sideline, more controversial, Freud, thoroughly European, trained in psychology, loved ancient Greek, loved ancient Egypt as well. Well, for him, a particular form of attitude, of psychological development of a human male, was, in his view, the Oedipus complex. Well, insofar as Freudian psychology has infected or affected a lot of the way we think of human character development, especially psychosexual, well, the Oedipus myth is absolutely central to that. So, in its way, Thebes has had a terrific legacy on modern European, mainly European, obviously Western, Euro-American culture.
That was Professor Paul Cartledge. If you found today's podcast interesting, then please do drop us a line with ideas of topics or historians that you'd like us to include in the series. You can do that on our social media channels at History Extra. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Ben Hewitt and Jack Bateman. Tune in again tomorrow for a discussion about the survival strategies of medieval royal dynasties.